Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, David, Jay, and Vicki will sit down with Billy Thomas, Extension Forester with the University of Kentucky. As always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning, Jay.
You know, David, for some reason or another, I think we're going to have a good time this morning.
I guarantee it. If the next 45 has been as fun as the last 10, it'll be all right. I guarantee it.
It's going to be great. I can already tell.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have been in Lexington, whether that's considered Mecca or Medina, whatever it is, it's the
Golden Triangle.
Corner of the Golden Triangle. Yeah. We've been in Lexington for the past couple of days, meeting with a lot of specialists that we don't normally get a chance to meet with. You know, we work with a lot of people around Princeton and have always had good relationships with specialists across the state. But every once in a while, it's good to get up here. It's good to sit down with folks. And sitting down with somebody I've worked with a lot before, maybe new to David and Vicki, but Billy Thomas from the Forest Department.
Well, hello. I'm so glad to be with you all today.
We're glad to have you. Glad to have you. You know, first off, why don't you just talk a little bit about yourself, how you came to work in forestry. I know you spent some time as an extension agent as well, and share that with our listeners.
Yes. Thank you. Again, I appreciate being on here with you all and the opportunity to speak about forestry and its importance to Kentucky. And I know many of your landowners are also woodland owners as well, so hopefully they'll get some good information out today. But, you know, I got into forestry really because I grew up in southeast Kentucky, Bell County, Cumberland Gap area, playing around in the Cumberland River on the banks of that and climbing up in the hills of Pine Mountain, playing around Chain Rock, if you've ever been down there.
Have.
You know, there's a giant chain that keeps that rock from falling on Pineville. So that's pretty important. But, no, I did really enjoy being outside. And my father, you know, he took me out a bit, went squirrel hunting when I was little. So I enjoyed being outside. Then I moved on, you know, we moved around. He was in the military, and we lived all over the place, all over the country, really. He was a recruiter, and they'd move him every couple of years. Okay. And, you know, I really started missing Kentucky, you know, when we went to some, like, other places. Nothing against Indiana or some of these other places, but they weren't, like, the hills of Kentucky that I knew and loved. And, you know, so I ended up having that longing to get back to those woods and ended up, you know, going to university for a little while and kind of figuring out what I wanted to do after a stint in the military, which was over in the desert, and that was a little another reason that made me want to get back to the hills. But so I found forestry, you know, there at the University of Kentucky and talked to some of those professors, and I was like, you know, this is something I could really get into. So that got me into it, and I really have just loved it ever since. I got my undergrad there at UK and then went on to get a master's degree looking at surface mine reclamation in eastern Kentucky, and that meant a lot to me too, because all of my family were coal miners, on both sides, right? So my dad, and I remember him coming home, he was an underground miner, and he would just be black. I mean, completely black. The only thing you could see was his eyeballs and his teeth, and everything else was just black, covered in that. And I knew I didn't really want to go underground like that, to be honest. So the opportunity to work in reclamation and try to make those areas better and productive was a real draw for me. So, you know, I've been so blessed and fortunate to be able to work in this. And then after I got out of, you know, school there, I took a job as a county extension agent in Elliott County. And, man, I tell you, that's a lot of work. It really is. But it's a loving it was just so great. I really loved that, the opportunity to help people solve issues and challenges that they were facing. And, you know, I had a lot of tobacco growers there. So I learned real quick how to say, I don't know the answer, but I'll get back to you real quick, you know. And I have a real feel and a warm place in my heart for all county extension agents, because you just never know what's going to come across that desk or on that phone call, you know, and you're kind of expected to know everything about everything. And that's a challenge sometimes.
You know, and it's more of a challenge in certain parts of the state than it is others. I've heard people say, well, there's not as much ag in East Kentucky. Maybe we don't need ag agents like we once did. And I've corrected more than one specialist, UK specialist, who has made that comment, because to me, in the western part of the state where I am, I have a lot of different ag industry representatives that producers also can rely on for information. But if you're in a small county, even in the western part of the state, or especially the eastern part of the state, that you don't have all that ag infrastructure to help support, the ag agent may be the only person in that county to go to with natural resource related questions. And to me, there's maybe should be more emphasis on that single agent in a county that does not have a lot of ag infrastructure backup.
You know, Jay, I appreciate you saying that, and I know all of our fellow agents out there appreciate that as well. And it is true, you know, especially I have seen these county offices that are small in these smaller counties. They are just so vital, so important. And as you said, there's not a lot of other support out there in those counties. So, right. You know, a big hat tip to all of our county extension offices and agents and staff. You know, it's a great resource we have here in Kentucky. I've had a chance to be around some other states, and I'm telling you, I think we're doing pretty good here, to be honest.
I think so, too. Kentucky's a pretty good place.
Yeah.
Regardless of the good people that make it up, Kentucky's just a pretty good place. You mentioned living in Indiana for a while. Mm-hmm. I've got a good friend who lives down in Harrodsburg who was born and raised in kind of south central Indiana. He says, you know, I wasn't born in Kentucky. He said, but I got here as quick as I could.
I love it.
Well, before we go any further, I do want to thank you for your service. You mentioned that you were in the military.
Yes, ma'am.
And, you know, we don't want to let the opportunity pass without thanking you for your service. And any of our other listeners out there that has served in the military, we certainly do. I think I'm speaking for my fellow agents here that's sitting here beside me, David and Jay, that we do appreciate the service, and we do respect that. And
absolutely.
And just don't want to let that pass by.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. So, we've got you up to the point that you were an extension agent, worked in Sandy Hook there in Elliott County.
Yes,
and,
sir.
And you came back to main campus to the forestry department.
So. Oh, you know, I had a little jig and jag along the way. Right. I worked in the private sector a little bit after I was a county agent. And largely I left that county office because I felt like they needed more traditional ag than I could support. Back to your point you made a minute ago, right? Too many times I was having to say, I don't know. And I wanted to be a helpful resource for those folks. So I felt like maybe getting somebody in there that had a little more traditional ag could have been a little more helpful to them. And I had an opportunity to work in the private sector for a little while, and that was good. But it's a lot different when you're always talking about billable hours, right? You know, as opposed to how can I help people.
It is different. I mean, and I think we all have to jig and jag just a little bit to kind of figure out where we are our best and where we can help people the best, you know. And I think it's interesting that, you know, just listen to your story because, you know, we all have that. And but, you know, you keep going back to, I just really enjoy helping people. I really enjoy doing things and being able to answer questions and being a resource for people. And that's what Extension's all about. I mean, that is what we do. And when you take us out of that environment and put us in an environment where those billable hours are those, you know, those sales thing, you know, quotas that they want you to meet, it's a different world.
Oh, very well said, Nikki. Yes.
Well, with the forestry department, talk a little bit about some of the programs you've been involved in and what your role with Extension Forestry is.
Well, I'm an extension forester, and really what that means is I'm here to help landowners the best I can. Now, I'm not the person that goes out and walks your property with you, right? That we have the Kentucky Division of Forestry, and we have private foresters out there that can do that work. My job is more in education and facilitation and bringing people together, helping identify issues in Kentucky that are important to our woodland owners, maybe things that aren't on everybody's radar, and getting them prepared to deal with them and helping them when there's a crisis, you know, whether it's a tornado, a flood or storm or insect outbreak or somebody's got a question about how much their trees are worth. Whatever we can do to try to help people be good stewards of the land, that's what we're trying to do. And here in Kentucky, our woodlands are really, really important, right? They make up about half the state. Over 12 million acres of Kentucky are woodlands. That's a lot.
That's
right?
A big number, and I don't know that. I would dare say that most people don't know that.
You know, and most people who do have an idea think, well, that's East Kentucky.
And it's not. It's
where,
all of Kentucky.
It's probably
really
where the concentration is of the mass. But when you get out across the state, even in our part of the state, Western Kentucky, we have a lot of wood lots.
You really do.
Smaller woodlands. But they're woodlands just the same. And they're a resource that our landowners should know a little bit about managing. And that's where you all come in.
Thank you so much. Yes, we want to help people take care of their woods. And even if you only have a few acres of woods. Those are important, right? Every acre matters here in Kentucky. Our woodlands do so much for us in so many ways. And we could talk about the economics of them, but they also do a lot of things for environmental considerations. You know, you think about cleaning water, and certainly those bottomland hardwoods you all have out there are vitally important to filter that water as it makes its way across the land, especially across ag land, getting into those streams and rivers. It does a lot of cleaning there, and that's really important. It also provides critical habitat for wildlife, recreational opportunities. You know, hunting and fishing are all supported by having healthy woodlands. So they do so much for us beyond just supplying timber and wood products that we use every single day.
You know, you touched upon something there with the recreational use and the wildlife habitat, and this has long since been a big issue of mine personally, and really if folks knew, it should be an issue to them personally too. Part of having that recreational opportunity and part of that wildlife habitat is maintaining our forest. And most people's, I won't say most, a lot of people's ideas of not of maintaining the forest means not cutting it. And to me, especially as a bird hunter and as a grouse hunter, something I've traveled all across the country doing, if we're not cutting trees, we're not really managing that habitat to the best of our ability for wildlife. A lot of our wildlife depends on successional change in our forests, and successional change means cutting timber and having regrowth and having that spontaneity of other species or suppressed species come back. You know, talk a little bit about that as far as your role as sure. an educator.
You bring up a really good point there. In Kentucky, a question I always get is, are we cutting too much of our trees, right? Are we cutting more than we're growing? And the answer is no. We're really growing about twice as much volume as we're harvesting on an annual basis. The problem comes in what we're harvesting, right? Mm-hmm. It's not uniformly spread across all that growth. It's concentrated into really a handful of species. You think about mm-hmm. white oak and yellow poplar and chestnut oak and a handful of species, and some hickories make up a huge majority of that volume that's being harvested. Now, they're not all of that growth that we're getting, right? So we're getting some changes in our forest. And you bring up another good point is habitat, right? We have to have a diversity of habitat. And when you have solid, large blocks of forest land, there's not a lot of diversity in habitat. And if you talk to any wildlife biologist, they'll tell you, you have to have a diversity of habitat nearby or on your own property to attract a wide variety of wildlife. And they need different habitats at different stages of their lives. And,
right.
and you're right, when we have all those big blocks, there's not that early successional habitat that creates the environment for some of these species that we want to try to attract and provide homes for.
You know, one of the things that I think about as you say that, is we've seen that change in our forests go from that predominant oak hickory type landscape to having a lot more maples than what we had years ago. And managing those maples may be a big, big part of what's not being done right now.
Well, you know, it's funny you bring that one up, too. You know, over the last few years, I've had the chance to work on a maple syrup project here in Kentucky. And I guess it's kind of making lemonade, you know, when you got a bunch of lemons, to be honest. Because here in Kentucky, if you look at the statistics, the number one tree, as far as the number of trees that are out there, if you counted every single tree in Kentucky that was greater than 1 inch in diameter, it would be red maple. And that is fastly growing, and that number is growing quicker and quicker. So we are seeing a change in our forests, and a lot of that is with how we're treating the land and how we treated it in the past, right? And that comes down to, you know, trying to be good stewards of that. But we're not going to change probably getting rid of all the maple, right? So it's a matter of working with it. And one good thing about the maple is, and sometimes it'll grow in areas where maybe it won't be as competitive with our oaks and other areas, right? So there's places for maple for sure. It's a really important species. And a lot of our maple syrup producers are thankful for having all this maple.
Absolutely.
But it is part of the challenge when we're dealing with oaks and some of these other things, trying to kind of control that maple population so that it doesn't outcompete our oaks, which are a little slower growing, and they need a little head start before they can be successful.
Are they naturally seeded, or is that folks planting those? Or I mean, how's that?
Right.
I mean, what's the cause of that?
Well, they really say it's kind of a mesification, right? We're getting kind of moisture and wetter, and that's better conditions. And it's really also, I'd say, largely more driven by land use change. If you think back to when we had the iron furnaces and some mm-hmm. of those other things, it took a lot of cutting, right? A lot of clearing of land, and it was some pretty harsh on the land, to be honest, but oaks like that disturbance, right? They really do, and they can thrive in that disturbance, and they were able to be successful. We also had the loss of the American chestnut, which freed up a lot of space there, and oaks and hickories largely took that. As we got, you know, away from some of those abusive practices, to be honest, things started kind of solidifying up, and the maples were able to survive. And they also have more shade tolerance, so they can grow in more shaded environments. So when you have these intact canopies and you don't get a lot of light on the forest floor, it doesn't create the environment for oaks to regenerate and be successful. And we know that if we don't get our oak trees up to about 4.5 feet in height and they're vigorous before that canopy comes off, they're not likely to be in there in the end of that rotation. Yellow poplar and other red maple and other things are most likely going to take over that site.
You spoke of the total disturbance that was the practice of the day. To me, the opposite extreme of that is, I guess, kind of a self-developed problem, and that was selective harvest. It's a good idea. And it's one of those things that maybe that first time over a woodlot, you know, going in and cherry picking the best to be harvested was good for that woodlot. But after we do that two or three times, we only end up with what's left. And what's left is those trees that were not harvested over those past two or three times. Along with that, that has allowed our maples to basically develop, like you said. They're very shade tolerant. They can grow in the shade of any kind of tree where oaks can't.
You bring up a really good point there. If we think about raising cattle, right, is that the way we would raise our cattle? We would take the very best each year?
And just breed. Keep the worst breed?
Right. There are
some folks that do that, yes.
Not for long, probably, right?
But there it does happen.
Right. So you're totally right. And we have changed our forest, right, with our practices. And that selective harvest, I know for many landowners, well, I didn't cut all my trees, right? So that's a good harvest. Maybe no, right? And that's really one of the reasons we try to encourage folks to have a professional forester on there, somebody that's educated in the growth and development of our tree species, and they know how they'll respond to different practices and different cutting intensities, and knowing when it's time to cut and maybe when you shouldn't cut. And a lot of times people treat their woods as a bank account that they'll just draw down in an emergency or a crisis. Right. And I argue it's a farm asset. Treat it like a farm asset, right? You're paying taxes on it. It serves you, and it serves your family, and it serves your community. Mm-hmm. Treat it like a farm asset and manage it like a farm asset. And the great thing about our woodlands is you don't have to be there every day. It's not like you're a dairy farmer, you know, where you're out there milking the cows every day. You just have to be out there at some key moments in the development of that woodland, and you can really have a very positive impact. So real quick, before we get off that selective harvest, you know, I always tell people, be careful with that, right? Really be careful, because what happens 99% of the time is it results in a high grade. And a high grade is basically where we go in and we take the very best trees and we leave the rest. So that's problematic for a couple of reasons. One, it degrades the stand over time, as you were alluding to, but it also doesn't create the conditions to get regeneration. So you get one single tree out of the way, not enough light is reaching the forest floor to regenerate the tree species that we want to be successful going forward. So it's like, not only am I undermining my value, but I'm actually changing the habitat for the trees that I want to be there. So it's like a double negative, really, in a lot of ways.
What does, like, when we're logging, of course, when you're driving by and you're seeing where they are doing logging, and you know, those, that heavy equipment and those log trucks, I mean, what effect does that have on the trees that are left? I mean, what, just that heavy equipment, because, you know, when you're building a house, so, you know, when you're doing that and you have heavy equipment and all that, a lot of times you'll see some trees that were there just start to decline, and it could very well be because of all the heavy equipment on there, or is that an issue?
It can be. And Vicki, you bring up another important point there. Here in Kentucky, we have the Kentucky Master Logger Program. That was enacted really back in 2000. I think in 98, they passed the Kentucky Forest Conservation Act, and they gave it a couple of years to kind of go into effect. But it requires that in Kentucky, if there's a commercial timber harvest, that means somebody's taking it to a mill to be sold, that you have to have a Kentucky master logger on site and in charge of that operation. And these master loggers have to go through a training program, and it's really almost 100% geared toward protecting water quality. Mm-hmm. Because when we're doing logging and that type of work in the woods, the biggest chance we have of doing some harm is to the water, really. If we don't do the roads right and we're not careful in how we go about that, we can cause some problems. So we have in place best management practices that guide how loggers can go about this. And really, it's tied in as part of the Ag Water Quality Plan, which I'm sure you all talk about a lot.
That's what I was waiting to interject. You talk about that coming about in 98. Ag Water Quality Plan took place in 96. Part of that plan was developing the silviculture BMPs, which led to the discussion that ultimately ended up with the Master Logger Program.
Yes, it did. And we're thankful to have that program. It's a really important program here. We have over 2,500 loggers in Kentucky that have gone through that program actively right now. And they have to maintain their certification by getting continuing education. So we want to make sure they stay current on what's going on out there in the woods and make sure they're doing things the best that they can. But back to your original question, Vicki. If you think back to some of that disturbances we had, some disturbance is good for certain species, right? Too much disturbance or too much compaction, yes, it can alter what trees can be successful there. But a lot of times those trees will resprout back, you know. So if you get some damage during a harvest, as long as it's not to a major tree and they're smaller trees, those things will sprout back largely. And our oaks are really good about that. The oak strategy and growth is I'm going to put down a lot of roots, right? Mm-hmm. And it spends its first few years really developing a healthy, robust root system, which gives it that chance to be ready when there's some sunlight that comes down. Wow. And then when that sunlight hits the floor, it's able to respond to that and really take off. So for some of our oaks, it's okay to actually be a little abusive and beat some of them down because there's a good chance, you know, depending on the situation, that they may come back very vigorously. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times when we're harvesting, we will use those sprouts as part of that natural regeneration going forward. We anticipate. And again, that's important when you have a professional on there on that property to look at that harvest, lay that harvest out. You're more likely to have the results that you want in the end. And I can't tell you how many calls I get. Billy, I had a timber harvest, and it didn't go the way I wanted. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, it's hard to put the trees back up. You know, it really is. So yeah, we want to make sure we do it the right way. Landowners only get it one or two times in their lifetime, unless they're very large landowners, to have a timber harvest. It takes a long time to grow these trees. If we're going to do it, let's do it the right way. Let's make sure that those woods are in good shape going forward and they have that species composition we're looking at, and those woods are going to be in a position to really achieve your objectives for your property.
Yeah. When people plant back and say they have a timber harvest and they're looking to plant back, you know, some folks plant pine and because it's fast growing and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, what do you see folks doing? Are they planting pines? Are they planting back hardwoods or a combination of both? Or, you know, what's a good mix,
right?
I guess, you know, we'll talk about forages and that's something I can talk about. But what's a good mix in a woodland, you know, when you're trying to plant back?
Well, I think diversity is the key, right? You know, you want to have a good diverse mix. And then fortunately here in Kentucky, we have about 120 native tree species, right? More than 20 different oaks, probably 15 or so different hickories, bunch of maples, ash, all kinds of different species out there. So you want a diversity, right? We don't have natively occurring a lot of pine species in Kentucky, and they actually make up a very small percentage. In western Kentucky, a lot of pines were planted. Mm-hmm. You know, we had some paper companies and others out there that were really promoting and pushing some pines out there, and we still have some legacy plantations that are out there. But largely here in Kentucky, we rely on what we call natural regeneration. So that's the seeds, the seedlings, and those sprouts that are out there on that site that will reoccupy that site. One of the challenges of planting trees in a woodland is that you're planting a tree with a very small root system, and it's got to compete with some of these trees that have massive root systems, so they just cannot be competitive without a lot of work, right? So we can, and sometimes we do what we call enrichment planting. So perhaps we don't have the species on site that we want, then we might come in and do an enrichment planning. But I'll tell you, David, it's a lot of work. It really is. You have to control that competition to make sure that those trees are successful. And unfortunately, that is challenging work, right? I mean, you have to get out there in a very timely manner, especially those first few years, to make so if you're going to do that, know that you're just not going to plant them and walk away, or you're not going to be really happy with the results that you end up with.
You know, that brings up a point. You kindly touched on it a little bit earlier. A lot of us come to our landowner position at different times or different stages of that forest growth. Not all of us get in on it at the very beginning. I take my personal farm, for example. When I bought it 11 years ago now, it had been 12 years since it had been harvested. So we're talking 23 years now. There's a lot of places where I can see a lot of growth and a lot of development. There's a lot of places that I see that did not really respond the way they should have because of that first 10 years. I'm involved with kind of, I guess, what I call a self-imposed timber stand improvement project right now. I'm doing some crown release. I'm doing some thinning of some species that really don't need to be there. And there's not really a market for those. You touched on landowners looking at their timber as a bank account. They see those things that really don't have a market for them, and they just let them go. And that's been a long-term problem across the state, really, a long-term issue for that particular land.
Yep, and you're totally right. And, you know, Jeff Stringer, or Dr. Jeff Stringer, who's our department chair at UK Forestry and Natural Resources, he talks about how the value of our woodlands are really probably about 25% of what they could be, you know, to be honest. And that's really largely based on that abuse that we've done, that selective harvesting, and the fire is still an issue, right? We have a lot of fire-damaged woodlands out there, and you know, cattle and woods don't always go together, too. You find a lot of hollow trees when the cattle have been in the woods.
Mineral deposits and things like that.
So there are some abuses that we do that really can kind of make it harder to get the results that we want. You're totally right. And again, that's why I encourage folks, work with professionals, right? And you mentioned there may not be a market for some of that low-grade or small material that you're dealing with, but there are financial assistance programs available to help landowners offset the costs that go into that. I'm talking about EQIP primarily, and I'm hoping your listeners are familiar with that, but through the Natural Resources Conservation Service, there's a program called the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, and it provides technical as well as financial assistance to landowners who are trying to implement conservation practices on their property. And there are many, many available for woodland owners to do these practices. So, but to get those on your property, you have to have a forest management plan. So you can't get that unless you're working with a professional forester. So really encourage your listeners to take advantage of these resources and these professionals that are out there to help them take care of their woodlands in a way that's going to meet their objectives, but make them healthier and productive, not only for today, but for tomorrow as well.
Good point.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk a little bit about where our listeners and folks could find publications? Are you? I know you all do a lot of videos. Where can they go to find these? And what types of topics and information can they find when they get there to look at them?
Vicki, thank you for that lead-in. I would really encourage your listeners, if they have any interest in the woodlands here in Kentucky, to check out our website. ukforestry.org is a quick little shortcut that'll get you there. Again, that's ukforestry.org. And when you get there, you'll see that we have a wealth of information. There's a number of publications on all kinds of woodland management, wildlife management topics. We have a wildlife professor, Dr. Matthew Springer. We have a forest health expert, Dr. Ellen Crocker. We have someone that's really kind of dealing with the changing climate, too, and carbon and that stuff in our forest, and Dr. Jacob Muller. So we have three faculty that are part of our extension team and a number of staff members, including myself, that cover a wide variety of areas within forestry. We cover wood products. We cover logging. We cover youth. So if you've got children or others that are interested, 4-H or FFA, we have programs and information for those. And we also have a connection to a lot of the other agencies and organizations are there. So you can get to ukforestry.org, and you can find all of these other people that can help you. You mentioned some of the videos and stuff like that. We do a program every week, From the Woods Today, and your listeners, if they wanted, they could join us every Wednesday at 11 live on YouTube or Zoom, and that's fromthewoodstoday.com. And what we do there each week, and similar like what you all are trying to do with this podcast, is get the word out. And we try to promote forestry, wildlife, natural resource-related topics, very much like you all are doing here, but we're doing it online where you can have some video with it, too.
You mentioned some of our sister organizations, if you will. When I look across the College of Ag and see a lot of the different state and federal agencies that we all work with, I always felt like the Forestry Department at UK probably had as good a working relationship with their sister organizations as any. You just really work well with the Department of Forestry, with NRCS, with different groups like that.
Thank you. We do. We do a program each year called the Kentucky Woodland Owner Short Course, and that engages about 10 of our different partners, including the Kentucky Division of Forestry, the Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife Resources, Natural Resources Conservation Service, also the Kentucky Woodland Owners Association. There's a whole group of woodland owners out there that kind of gather and are working on behalf of woodland owners. So if we've got any woodland owners out there, I'd throw a plug for them to check out kwoa.net, and that's the Kentucky Woodland Owners Association. I just got back from their annual meeting. I've been down in Lake Cumberland the last 3 days at their annual meeting. And to see the passion that these people bring for woodland management and caring for the woodlands, I tell you, it just inspires me. And I feed off of that energy and that love. So there's a lot of help. There's a lot of support out there. And I encourage your listeners to take advantage of that. So check us out on ukforestry.org. Join us at our Woodland Owner Short Course this summer, and you'll get a lot of information, and you'll get a lot of connections to people that can help you on your own property.
You know, let's spend a little time talking about the Woodland Owner Short Course itself. As an ag agent, when I was in Christian County, I had a chance to work with you and Jeff and Renee, and everybody hosted you all on one of those weekends. Talk a little bit about the different levels, the two different levels of that program, and how there's something offered there for forest owners of any level.
Right, yeah, so we try to make it accessible regardless of where your entry level's at. You know, some people have a lot of experience. They've been out in the woods. They've been working with the woods. They may have been working with professionals for a long time. But there's always something new, you know, that's coming down the pike that they can learn about, maybe a new program, a new threat, a new market, whatever. So there's stuff for them, but there's really a lot for those that are not aware of all of this. So we have information for both of these groups. And this year we're doing it in a hybrid format, so we're having four evening online sessions that will be recorded as well. So in case you couldn't make one of them, you would be able to check that out. And those are going to be lead-ups into our two field sessions. And we're going to have a field session on July 15th at Pennyryle State Forest. So hopefully, you know, in the heart of where you all are at. So if you want to join us there, I encourage you to sign up and register for the Woodland Owner Short Course. But so you would take those four evening sessions in advance, and we hope to cover topics including wildlife management, forest health, woodland practices, tree identification, and some of these base things so that when we get out in the woods, we can actually get our hands on some trees and look at some different things in a little more of a hands-on matter and show people some different practices that have been out there. We're also going to go look at some recent timber harvests on each of those two field sessions so they can see what a timber harvest looks like. But we really want to talk about the planning that goes into those timber harvests and that follow-up work to make sure that those woodlands end up in the way that we want to do.
You know, along with our published show each week, we have online show notes that folks can look at. We'll be sure to include all the links that you've mentioned in our show notes. Most especially to me is the Woodland Owner Short Course. It's one of those things that I've helped do as an agent. I've always wanted to take time off and go do as a woodland owner because I feel like sitting in the audience, I would have a different experience than working in the background of trying to keep a program like that going.
Well, I would encourage you to do that and bring some friends, right? We want to get people out to this program because every time people say, Billy, I had no idea there was so much help, so much assistance available. Yeah, so I think people, when they come to this program, they leave much better prepared to take care of their woods and know where to go to get that assistance. And getting the right information at the right time is critical.
Sure. You know, that you mentioned the information you receive. There's a lot of hands-on that you do. There's a lot of classroom that goes along with this. they leave with quite a bit of technical information. I've still got my yellow folder from helping you all do that, I'm assuming that. I don't know about the CD. Is that still relevant?
Well, we've kind of moved those things to online now. So, you know, it's changed over time. We did have a little USB drive for a little while, but people were like, wow, I don't even have something to plug this thing into anymore.
Just give me a link.
So most of that stuff's now available online for folks to get. But, yeah, it's a great resource. We do send them away with a resource binder, that yellow binder, and it warms my heart to see those yellow binders across the state on somebody's pickup truck. Dash, you know, and that they're using those binders as a resource to help them care for their woodlands.
If somebody wants to register for that course, how do they go about doing that?
Well, registration's not up yet. It will be soon, so I would say just stay tuned to ukforestry.org, and it'll be posted right there real soon. And you can just search for Woodland Owner Short Course, and we have a specific page for it, but I won't say that long URL.
And I will say that also they'll send that out to all of the county extension agents, so if you're in a county and you would like to register for that, also reach out to your extension office, and they will certainly be able to get you that information that you need to be able to get registered and be able to take that course too.
Yes, thank you, Vicki. And I would say to your listeners, too, if for some reason those field sessions don't work for you, we still want you to come to the online sessions, mm-hmm. Because you can still get a lot of information from those online sessions. So please, even if you can't go to that field, register so you can get those online sessions. And even if the dates don't work for you, you can watch the recordings later, mm-hmm. and you'll be able to follow up with us with questions.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. Billy, one of the things that we kind of get questions about, and you talked about, you know, if you're going to plan a timber harvest or something like that, you need to be working with a forester. Where can these, and that's the questions we get at our office, is, you know, where do I find one? How do I find one? You know, how do I get started?
Right. Thank you, David. I appreciate that. What we really want to do is encourage landowners to get the help they need, right? And when you're dealing with forestry and forest management, we think that foresters are best positioned to give you that assistance because they have that technical training, and most of them have experience in the areas that they're working. So they know, you know, what's going to happen when certain practices are done. They can tell you what some of the threats, some of the risks that those are, and that's just invaluable information. So we here in Kentucky, we have several different groups of foresters that are available to work with woodland owners, and really that our kind of first line that we send folks to is the Kentucky Division of Forestry. That is a state agency, and they're based out of Frankfort, but they have regional offices spread out across Kentucky, and there is an office in Madisonville that serves western Kentucky, and you can contact those folks there at that office, just Kentucky Division of Forestry, and you'll find that Madisonville office pretty easy. But regardless where you're at in Kentucky, mm-hmm. they serve every single county. So they have professional foresters that are called service foresters, and their job is to go out and work with woodland owners one-on-one, develop a forest management plan for them. And that plan is more than just kind of a piece of paper that we want on a shelf. This is really your roadmap to what you're going to do, your directions, really, your cookbook, if you will, on how you're going to make your property be what you want it to be, right? What position, what shape you want it to be in. So they'll help make those prescriptions for you. They'll inventory your property. They're not going to be able to measure every tree, but they can use some statistical sampling to get a good assessment of what you have. They can let you know if you have any issues going on. Maybe it's invasive plants. Unfortunately, we deal with those all the time. And if we can get those while they're small and not a whole hillside of them, it's a lot easier to deal with. Yeah. But the Kentucky Division of Forestry is the first group I would send landowners to, and that is free of charge, but please keep paying your taxes because that's how I get supported.
That was my next question, is if there was a charge anything like that.
The only charges that they have is they can mark timber for you. They can mark up to 50 acres, I believe, a year for a landowner, and they charge for the paint, for marking the trees. But other than that, there's really no charge for their services. And they provide that critical link of developing that forest stewardship plan, which is really your key, David, to get into those conservation programs through the Natural Resources Conservation Service through their EQIP program.
That's the starting point. You have to have that.
You have to have that management. And that's important, right? It's more than just a piece of paper. This is our intentions, right? That lays out the objectives for that property. It lays out the inventory information for that property. It identifies problem areas or issues, and then it puts together prescriptions on what we need to do to address those issues. And those prescriptions are what are typically funded through EQIP, right? Whether it's a tree planting project or, you know, you need to fix a stream or fix a road or you need to do some of that crown release work that you're talking about there. Regardless of what the work is, there's probably a program that will cover that or a practice that will cover that under the EQIP program.
All good stuff. You know, we've talked this whole show about the landowner side, about working with landowners, which within Extension, that's what we do. Talk just a little bit as we get towards the end about the forest industry in general in the state of Kentucky so that folks can kind of link the two together about what managing their resource means in dollars and in businesses across the state.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, it's really another one of those things that's kind of out of sight. Somehow, right? Our forest industry is huge in the state. It really is. And I think part of the reason people don't think of it as being us being a big forest industry state is because it's so diffuse. It's really spread out across the state, right? So you don't see huge concentrations in really one area or another. But it's all over Kentucky. It really is. We do each year a economic contribution of the forest sector in Kentucky, right? We are looking at the data across the state. We use a wide variety of sources. And I really got to give a hat tip to the Kentucky Division of Forestry and the U.S. Forest Service, who provides a lot of that data for us. So supporting them helps us kind of get a good assessment of what's going on in our woodlands. But here in Kentucky, we estimate about $13 billion total economic contribution each year. Each year, right? We estimate over 25,000 Kentuckians are directly employed in the forest industry in Kentucky. That means they actually work in a wood industry. And if you expand that on to those that are kind of that induced or, you know, that kind of impacted by the forest industry that wouldn't have jobs if there wasn't a forest industry in there, that number grows to about 50,000 Kentuckians are dependent on the forest industry. That's a lot. That's a lot of jobs, right? It really is. And then you talk about $9 billion directly come out of the forest industry here as an economic contribution to the state. I talked about 2,500 master loggers, about 700 different facilities spread out across Kentucky. So it's really important. It really is. And probably 90% of the wood that goes into that those facilities, guess where it comes from? From woodland owners in Kentucky, right? It really does. We do import a little bit from surrounding states, and we ship out a little bit, but really the vast majority of the wood processed in Kentucky is grown in Kentucky by woodland owners in Kentucky. So that connection is critical, right? They are that first step or that first link in that supply chain of developing that. And, you know, one of the things we do in our little economic contribution report is we make a guess or an estimate on how much each acre of harvested timber that contributes to the economy. And it's over $21,000 we estimate, because if you look at all those added things, you know, like landowners get, you know, maybe $1,000 or so an acre, you know, on a good piece of property. And then, you know, you look at the loggers, they add some value when they harvest it to it. And then they take it to a sawmill and that and then they cut it in. So they added some value to it then. It gets dried. They add some more value to it there all along the way till that finished product that, you know, that we end up using every day. So it's really important to Kentucky. It really is. So taking care of our woods, making sure that they're healthy and productive is important to every single one of us, whether you're in the wood industry or not, or if you're just doing whatever in Kentucky, healthy woods helps us all.
That's a good point, good point. I think of how much I've seen our timber industry grow across my lifetime. When I was young, went to log woods as a teenager helping people work. We had two cooperages in the next county over. So we were finding white oak wherever we could find it, and that's where it was going. And everything else just basically went to a small local sawmill and was locally used lumber.
Yeah.
And to us, that was the cap. I mean, that was really all that could be done with anything. I think of all things, I think of the growth of bourbon in the past 10 years and what that has meant to the state of Kentucky, the additional cooperages that have been able to not only just stay online but expand, the additional cooperages that have come in and gone to work all to make white oak barrels. And that's been a big, big part of our growth in the past few years.
In forestry, we claim bourbon as a wood product.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, honestly, if you think about it, without white oak trees, there is no bourbon. We got moonshine, but we don't have bourbon, right? 70% of the flavor and coloring and all of that comes from that wood, right? And wood is really one of the most valuable inputs that they have in producing bourbon, right?
Right, right.
So it is absolutely critical. And you bring up a really important point about white oak. That interest in white oak, oh, it's exploded, right? and it's largely right because of the interest in the cooperages, because they have to have a very high-quality log. Mm-hmm. You can't use kind of junk logs because they're going to be leaky barrels. So you have to have really good, high-quality logs to produce staves. So that has put a lot of pressure on all those other users of white oak as well, right? So we have seen over the years that value of white oak is just it's like a rocket ship flying into outer space. It's going up basically straight up, and it's really important. But that can also cause us some issues out in the woods right now if we're kind of overly harvesting these white oaks, right? You know, it can be a little problematic. So what's been done to try to address that is this thing called the White Oak Initiative, and I would encourage your listeners to check out White Oak Initiative. Just type that in, they'll bring you up to their website. And they've developed a series of things, but they did a conservation plan, and they really did an assessment of where white oak was across the landscape. And here in Kentucky, we're really in the center of the white oak range. It's really about a 17-18 state where most of the white oak area is, but Kentucky's like right in the middle. Us mm-hmm. in Missouri and, you know, Tennessee, we are like really where most of that white oak is grown and goes into those barrels. So the White Oak Initiative has put in a number of different programs and publications, but one series they got is Landowners for Oaks, and it really talks about all the different oaks that are out there, but also what we can do to manage for those oaks. So they have these different prescriptions that are really kind of little cookbook recipes on what we can do to try to get these species back on there, and they're trying to connect landowners with professionals to get that work done. So there's opportunities through that too, and that's a big partnership, so I encourage folks to check that out. And it's really exciting. You know, I just saw the other day in the Herald Leader, the paper here in Lexington, that the James Beam Still Industry or Institute here at UK just putting in this big state-of-the-art still, right? So we're going to be teaching students to how to get into the distillery industry. But if we don't take care of our white oak, right, and if we're not caring for those and managing for those white oak, I don't know how we're going to have bourbon.
Well, I was going to say, Kentucky's always been known as the bourbon state, the king of the bourbon state. But really, in all this recent growth in the past 10 to 15 years, our white oak forest is what has allowed this state to remain the king of the bourbon industry.
It really has. And, you know, we have that that long tradition, that long history. And I encourage our listeners to let's keep it going, right? But to keep it going, we have to care for our woods. And the best way we can care for our woods is to work with some professionals that are attuned to your area and know what's going on in your area, can give you good, sound advice, and then connect you with the programs to support you to do those practices over time. And, you know, there's a whole community out there that wants to help you take care of your woods, because we all benefit when woods are healthier and more productive.
You know, that's a perfect segue into our timely tip to wrap up the show for this week. I talked to you a little bit about before the show about what we do, and your timely tip that you furnished for us is let's get going. It's never too late to plant a tree. I think you said, if I can quote you, was, you know, the best time to plant a tree was a long time ago. So touch a little bit on that and a little bit about your thoughts on that.
Right. What I would say is, whether you've done a lot on your woods or not, there's still stuff that we can do. So get going on that, right? And get going by finding out, you know, first think about what you want out of your woods, right? You have to have some objectives for your woodlands. And that may be a little challenging at first because you may not know what you have. So you may have to work with a professional to kind of see what your options are.
Help develop those goals.
Exactly. But once you have those goals in place, and that's really the first thing that we're asking landowners, what do you care about? Are you interested in wildlife? Are you interested in timber? Are you interested in all of them, or recreation? Because that is going to guide what that forester recommends to do. So without those kind of guiding principles, you know, we're just going to kind of manage for healthy, productive, diverse woods. But if you let that forester know what you're interested in, then they can make really tailored recommendations that can help you get that. So I would encourage your listeners to get going, take care of your woods. It'll pay you and it'll pay your family for generations to come.
Well, that's a perfect place to end a good show. Billy, appreciate it. I've enjoyed working with you in the past. I think a lot of folks will enjoy the show that you've done with us today. So we appreciate you, and we want to thank our host for this week's information, and special thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.